Our meditation this morning is entitled, What Does a Chaplain Do? Our speaker is the Reverend Dr. James Aspiro, currently a board-certified clinical chaplain at the VA Portland Healthcare System. He's also a retired Lieutenant Commander, Chaplain Corps, United States Navy. His chaplain assignments were Destroyer Squadron 5 at San Diego, 1st Marine Division, Camp Pendleton, Tustin Marine Corps Air Station, Tustin, California, the Postgraduate School at Claremont School of Theology, Naval Station Iceland, the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory's Navy Training School, Supervisory Chaplain School, Newport, Rhode Island, and Command Chaplain, the USS Simon Lake at La Maddalena, Italy. After his retirement, he served as a chaplain at Oregon State Hospital and Linfield College until he became chaplain at the VA. After Jim's ordination in 1979, he was called to be a pastor of the American Baptist Church in Framingham, Massachusetts. During seminary and his church pastorate, he was a chaplain in the U.S. Air Force Reserves. In the late 60s and 70s, he was a musician in the Oregon Army National Guard. He earned degrees from the University of Portland, Yale Divinity School, and Claremont School of Theology. He did his clinical pastoral education at Yale New Haven Hospital. And the Kleinbell Institute Pastoral Counseling in Claremont, California. This year, Jim published a novel entitled Salt of the Earth, A Portland Story. He's married to Janet Aspiro, and who many of you know, has been around WOOF a lot recently. And they have 24-year-old twin daughters, Jenny and Julie. Please welcome the Reverend Dr. James Aspiro.
Thank you for that nice introduction. How does it go? Da 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 da. Bye bye bird. I just thought I'd make you all feel welcome today. That was a wonderful musical interlude we heard from the choristers. Thank you very much. You put a lot of work into that, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. Well, when people ask me what I do, and I answer, I'm a chaplain, most ask, well, what does a chaplain do? I'm sure some of you might wonder that yourselves. Well, it's hard to tell them in a few words, so it was gratifying to write this meditation to such an august group of individuals as in WOOF. To answer this question, I wrote a series of short vignettes that have stood out during my career. So what does a chaplain do? His large, dry hands, dusty brown and chafed from scraping rust from the ship all day, presented me with a letter soaked in tears. The ink was smeared. I'd just reported for duty to my first assignment as a chaplain in the Navy aboard the USS Fletcher, a Spruance-class destroyer. I was the chaplain to 6 carrier escort ships during this tour. There was a knock on my door where the young bosun's mate stood with his letter in his big hand. As I read the letter, this tall, thin young man from a farm somewhere in the Midwest could barely hold back his tears, which was unacceptable around his peers. It was a letter from his wife telling him that she met another man, a better man, and wanted a divorce. She stated in the letter that she's living with him and their 1-year-old baby now. The same day, on this first assignment in the Navy, the executive officer, the second in command of the ship, asked me to come to his office. He needed to talk to the chaplain because he just discovered the day before that his fiancée had died in a car accident. Well, the deployment took priority. These ships had to leave with the carrier. There was no waiting. No time for family problems, except in the chaplain's office. A week later, we left for a 7.5-month deployment with over 6 straight months at sea with no free time, or what we call in Navy liberty time, off the ship. We ended up with two tours in the Gulf of Oman on this deployment, as the carrier battle group that was there had to go to the Mediterranean because, as you recall, during the Reagan administration, a Marine Corps bunker was blown up in Lebanon. So we were stuck out there in the Gulf of Oman for two tours. Well, this was the start of a career with the Navy that included tragedies like this nearly every day. On this three-year tour, we did two Western Pacific deployments. And when deployed, I would fly in a helicopter from ship to ship to conduct divine worship services and visit the sailors. Now, the helicopter was when it was carrying a chaplain, it was called the Holy Hilo. And on Sundays, when mail was aboard, it was called the Pony Express. Some of the ships that were mine had no flight deck, so they would lower me down on a cable in a horse collar. This is what you do. You sit on the side of the helicopter with your feet dangling over the ocean, and they put a horse collar around. You hold on like this. Someone would tell you to hold on tight, and then they would push you out and lower you down. Now, the ship is going like this, right, in the sea? So the pilot has to do the same thing. And then the guy that's lowering you on the cable has to make sure that the cable gets you down aboard on the little tiny postage stamp size thing on the back of the frigate or whatever it was. And what they do is they have a... the whole ship has to go to flight quarters. There's firemen out there with their silver fire suits, and they have to take a hook and hook the cable, because if not, and he touches you, there'll be a huge static electricity shock for all for me and the guy down there. Luckily, they usually get it. And then they grab you and you run into the hangar. Also on this deployment, there was a main space fire on the Ranger aircraft carrier where seven people died. Everyone in the battle group was affected, as a fire on a ship at sea can be fatal for everyone. And there were many sailors on my ships who were friends with some of the sailors who died, and so it was around the Holy Hilo again to visit all of them on all the ships for that kind of counseling. We'll get back to the Navy later. What does a chaplain do? Her head was in a brace that kept it still as she'd broken her neck. I'm not sure why she was admitted to Oregon State Hospital, but she was there when I was a chaplain there, and I'll call her Grace. All Oregon State Hospital patients have committed a crime, and they are mentally ill. This is the same hospital that the motion picture One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was filmed. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. When Grace was in bed, all she could see was a gray wall because she could only lay on her right side facing the wall. And Grace loved to sing, of all things, Amazing Grace. She would lay there, stuck in her bed in one position, staring at the wall, singing Amazing Grace all day long. Her neck brace was a contraption that had a halo around her head to hold her neck straight, with screws in her head attached to the braces leading up to the halo. She would also sit in her wheelchair like this when not in her bed. Those are the only two positions she could be in. I enjoyed visiting Grace, as she was always so thrilled to get a visitor. She had no outside friends and no family. Well, before she landed in the intensive care ward, she lived in the geriatric ward, where she met Frank. Frank couldn't visit her as he was locked in the geriatric ward, as are all patients at Oregon State Hospital. Frank was a pika. Some of you may be familiar with what a pika is, but from Wikipedia, the disorder pika is characterized by an appetite for substances that are largely non-nutritive, such as ice, hair, paper, drywall or paint, metal, stones or earth, glass or feces, and chalk. You get the picture? He would eat anything. Both Frank and Grace attended the chapel service I conducted on Sundays in the geriatric ward. Frank was devastated that Grace was all alone and had broken her neck. He loved to draw using crayons, supervised only, or he would eat them. He drew for her a colorful picture depicting all her friends on the geriatric ward as stick figures, and he asked me to give it to her. Well, when I brought it, I taped it to the wall so she could look at something other than this gray wall. When she saw the picture for the first time, her face filled with tears of joy. "Did Frank draw this for me?" she cried. "He sure did," I replied. I'd never known anyone to be so happy as to stare at crayon stick figures. She looked at this picture, and as time passed, Frank gave her more pictures, and I would tape them all to the wall. Every time I came to visit her, she would just stare at her pictures with more joy in her heart than you could possibly imagine. I think the pictures made her happier than most of us ever could be. She would always smile at me with that halo brace around her head and say, "I'm the happiest woman in the world because I have a friend like Frank. I'm also the holiest person in the world. See my halo? It didn't get there all by itself. It got there by amazing grace. They even named the hymn after me." She would then smile with his big red lips. The staff would fuss over her and put makeup on her, which she demanded and loved. So that was the story of grace. What does a chaplain do? It was a beautiful sunrise in the Mojave Desert one spring morning. 300 Marines were in place for an Easter Sunday sunrise service when I was a battalion chaplain with a Marine Corps artillery unit on a training exercise at 29 Palms Marine Corps Training Center. During the service, I used intinction for communion for expedience's sake. It's not in my tradition, but you must improvise as a chaplain. Intinction is where you dip the communion wafer in the cup and place it on the tongue, like the Catholics and Lutherans do. Well, I conducted this service with a Missouri Synod Lutheran chaplain whose tradition demanded this form of communion. Chaplains work with chaplains representing a broad spectrum of faith traditions, even Unitarians. Recently, your church sent a chaplain, Susan McGinn, off to the Navy. Coincidentally, I had to interview her before she could get her commission. Since I'm the senior Navy chaplain in the area, if the recruiter is busy or tied up in San Diego, they call me. By the way, I've been told that she's doing a great job at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. She may have moved from there to another assignment since it's been a while since she left. We usually move around every couple of years. Back to the Easter Sunday sunrise service. The altar was on the hood of my Humvee. Many of the Marines were taller than me, so I had to reach up here to put a wafer in their mouth. And some were actually shorter than me, which is unusual. Well, they lined up with their cami uniforms and their weapons at their sides. Be that as it may, the most unusual thing about this service is that it was conducted on the east side of a hill, so we could see the sunrise. Well, this side of the hill was a private location, so they put the latrine there the day before. So off to the left of my service was the latrine. Now, the latrine consists of a hole in the ground with two places you're sitting back to back in the open air. Inasmuch as the Marines could participate in the divine worship service on Easter Sunday morning in the Mojave Desert, it was telling that a Marine was using the latrine while attending my worship service. I don't think anybody can claim that kind of experience. What does a chaplain do? Currently, I work at the VA Portland healthcare system. Several years ago, we had a patient in the palliative care unit who was simply beside himself. They pumped him up with anti-anxiety pills to calm him down and psychotropic drugs to fix what they thought was a mental disorder. He also had a speech deficit, which made it nearly impossible to communicate with him, so they drugged him as best they knew how. I had a great chaplain residence once who had the patience of Job. She just sat there with him and waited for opportunities to communicate. After many weeks of visiting him, she discovered that he was a Muslim and didn't know what direction east was in. He wanted to pray 5 times a day and was totally disoriented. Well, to solve the problem, we turned his bed toward the east and put a big sign with a big arrow that said east on it. Almost immediately, he calmed down. He could now pray 5 times a day and practice his faith tradition. They stopped all his drugs, and he became a very happy camper. This is one of the many instances where drugs and surgery may not solve everyone's problem. Government chaplains exist because of the First Amendment to the Constitution. We are there so that the government can't interfere with the free exercise of religion. Inasmuch as a Muslim has the right to pray five times a day, a Wiccan has the right to light a candle in the chapel, a Muslim can throw a prayer rug down and not have to look at Christian symbols, a Unitarian can believe whatever he or she wants to believe or not believe in. Therefore, we have no religious symbols in VA chapels. And by the way, we spend an awful lot of time keeping overzealous people from entering patients' rooms to hammer them over the head with their particular form of religion. So part of our job is simply to be a watchdog to make sure that everyone can exercise their First Amendment right. Chaplains in non-government hospitals and the like serve patients who don't have their own clergy. Chaplains are an integral part of the healthcare team and are looked to for advice and counsel. Back to my first Navy deployment with the Ranger Battle Group in 1984. When we were headed for Subic Bay, Philippines, I received a message from a chaplain who was already there, who brought some of his sailors to an orphanage in Subic Bay called King's Phil-Am Orphanage. It's still there to this day. You can Google it. A school teacher from Clark Air Force Base, that is, by the way, no longer there because of the Mount Pinatubo eruption, saw a need for an orphanage for unwanted half-American children. Her name is Arlene Dunn. I promised that I would bring some sailors to the home when our battle group arrived. I would always work out in the small gym on the ship and got to know some of the sailors there. There was one sailor, a first-class petty officer, who would always make a point of swearing in the presence of the chaplain and showed as much disrespect as possible. He was muscle-bound with years of tattoos from all over the Far East, a real tough guy. He lifted enough weight to sink the ship. We'll call him Petty Officer Blake. I went to the gym, hoping he was there. He was. I asked everyone if they could come to the orphanage and work. They would do this when they were on their free time, when they could finally get off the ship for some R&R, and we call it Liberty Call. It's what many sailors live for, to see the world on Liberty Call. But many sailors end up visiting the bars where they sometimes might get into trouble. So to ask them to work on a home for unwed mothers at an orphanage on their precious free time was asking a lot. I knew there would be some heavy lifting, and I wanted Petty Officer Blake to help. I also hoped he might learn something about himself at the orphanage. Everyone except Petty Officer Blake agreed to come to the orphanage when the ship pulled into port. On the Saturday we were scheduled to go to the orphanage, Petty Officer Blake's shipmates pulled him out of his rack and forced him to come with them. Well, he wanted to be with his friends, so it had to appear as if the big tough guy did not come to the orphanage voluntarily. He was forced to go. It's the only way we could get him there. I was elated when he got there. After a jeepney ride through Longapo City, we arrived at the orphanage with some shovels and tools from the ship. On the property, there was a two-story structure, the home for unwed mothers, under construction, that we continued working on from several other Navy ships who brought sailors there. I was on the second story accepting cement buckets from the crew below, who would mix the cement and hand the buckets up to me, and I would pass it on. Teamwork is great in the Navy. Petty Officer Blake was mixing cement with a shovel, as, of course, the cement mixer was broken, and he passed the buckets up to me, and this went on for several hours. Then Petty Officer Blake started to cry. He tried his best to hold back his tears, as he didn't want his friends to see him crying. I asked him to come out back with me to talk, and so we sat on a log. "What's going on?" I asked. Pastor Blake sat silently for several minutes. The only thing I remember doing to wipe his tears is that I found some scratchy old brown paper towels from the latrine. He used up several of them, and he's rubbing the dirt all over his face. Then he replied, "Chaplain, I've been in and out of Subic Bay for 10 years. I was playing catch with a young kid. He enjoyed it so much, more weeping. "I couldn't help thinking that this kid could be mine," he said. "I always thought that Subic Bay was an adult Disneyland for sailors. Not anymore. I had no idea this could happen from our fun. I hate myself." He fidgeted and thought deeply. "I always wanted to make you uncomfortable in the gym because I knew the truth deep down and I didn't want to face it. I'm sorry." Petty Officer Blake couldn't do much work the rest of the day. He just played with the kids with a tear in his eye the whole time. Eventually, Petty Officer Blake took the lead on the orphanage project and got more sailors from our ship to work there than they had ever seen. During the week, we nearly finished the cement work framing on the home, thanks to Petty Officer Blake. He also changed his demeanor in the gym. If anyone said anything inappropriate around the chaplain, he would ensure that this never happened again. After all, he was a bad dude, and nobody messes with a bad dude. I ended up taking sailors and Marines to orphanages, to nearly every duty station I was assigned. It's a magical relationship between a single lonely sailor and an orphan. What do chaplains do? I walked into a patient's room at the VA and introduced myself as the chaplain. The patient said to me, "I don't want no religion and no chaplain." I said, "Okay, that's cool. See you later." So I started to walk out. Then he stated, "Chaplain, don't you want to know why I don't want no religion?" I turned back and said, "Sure, tell me why you don't want no religion." "Well, it's like this, chaplain. Take my brother. He was younger than me, and he had religion, and now he's dead. I'm older than him, and I'm still alive. So can you see why I don't need no religion?" "Well, that's a funny way of thinking about it," I said. So I started to leave the room again, and he said, "One more thing, chaplain. You can visit me if I'm on my deathbed, but don't visit me until then. I don't want no guilt till I'm ready." So I said to him, "What are you feeling guilty about?" "Funny you should ask," he replied. This led to a long discussion over the course of perhaps 3 months about his past. He wanted desperately to talk to a chaplain about his values and the life he had led, but he was afraid to do so. Breaking through this veneer was gratifying. How do you become a chaplain? Well, there are many venues in which to become a chaplain. Excuse me. The traditional road is first to become a minister, priest, rabbi, imam, etc. This typically involves a 4-year college degree, a 3-year Master's of Divinity degree, endorsement by a recognized denomination by the Royal Council of Churches, and by the way, there's about 150 of them, and a full year of clinical pastoral education, or CPE as we call it. CPE helps to make clergy aware of the diversity of religious preferences and to be made aware of their own biases. This involves direct patient care, class didactics, peer reviews, individual supervision, and academic studies. There are 4 CPE programs in the Portland area: the VA, where I work, Oregon State Hospital in Salem, Legacy Healthcare System, and Providence Healthcare Systems. Just a word about the Portland VA healthcare system. We conduct several programs for veterans and their families: moral injury in the 12 steps, grief and loss, spiritual skills, military sexual trauma, marriage and committed relationship enrichment, organ transplant patient and family support, women's support groups, post-traumatic stress disorder and spirituality. We conduct worship services for many different faith groups. Those we can and those we can't, we facilitate. We participate in interdisciplinary treatment teams, and we are an integral part of the system. We're sort of, chaplains are like an institution, and we participate well with other disciplines, hospital. This is just a few slivers of what chaplains do. I hope you have a clearer picture. To shift gears, this won't take a second, I wrote a novel that was published recently entitled Salt of the Earth, A Portland Story. The book has many instances of what chaplains do, but that's not its main focus. The purpose of the book is to give voice to progressive churches like this one. There are very few plot-driven novels that have been written about progressive churches. Most of the novels you read are about evangelicals and fundamentalist stuff and all the stuff that's been going on recently, which none of us are happy about. Well, the back cover reads, Ben Dawson, widowed pastor, takes a bullet from an assault rifle triggered by an anti-abortion protester at a woman's health clinic. Further unanticipated events land him in the national spotlight. Colorful characters, including a brilliant and glamorous woman, are influenced by Ben's local progressive church, at which people of all spiritualities find purpose and meaning. Woven into the story is romance, adventure on the high seas, and a sensational dog. Best part of the book. I'll be in the basement during coffee hour, and if you want to purchase a book, I'll sign it for you. Also, all the profits from sales of the book today will go to the WOOF. So, thanks for listening to me.